Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com. /awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Don't touch that dial. You're tuned in to the Dread Podcast Network.
You are now listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris, where the most influential voices in horror cinema will spill their guts to the renowned horror director, writer, and producer. Now, here's your host, Mick Garris.
From Night Sky Productions' world headquarters overlooking the glamorous San Fernando Valley, I'm Mick Garris, and this is Postmortem. Let's go back, way back in time, to talk about the world's first movie monsters, the world's first actual monsters. Let's talk about dinosaurs. Dinosaur movies go back almost as far as movies themselves. Back in 1914, a popular cartoonist and animator named Winsor McCay created a 5-minute cartoon starring Gertie the dinosaur. Yes, it was a cartoon, but its popularity cannot be overstated. That same year, D.W. Griffith produced a movie that incorporated two kinds of movie monsters that would dominate the field for decades in a film called Brute Force. First, there was an alligator with fake bat wings and a crest applied, but it also featured the very first appearance of a stop-motion dinosaur, the Ceratosaurus. But what really kicked things off was in 1925 when Willis O'Brien created stop-motion animated clay dinosaurs in the first screen adaptation of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's prehistoric creature feature, The Lost World. O'Brien also created the groundbreaking stop-motion effects in 1933's King Kong and, in the next decade, Mighty Joe Young, where he was assisted by his brilliant young protege, Ray Harryhausen, who went on to be the all-time king of stop-motion monsters. Dinosaurs became a staple of movie magic, the best of which were animated frame by frame, and the worst by gluing fins and the like onto unsuspecting lizards, blown up to king size on the screen. There were dozens of other such creature features that were made magical by animators like Jim Danforth and Doug Beswick and Dennis Muren during the dino boom of the 1970s. And then it all changed when Steven Spielberg and his genius CGI team brought Jurassic Park to life, and there was no looking back. Digitally created dinosaurs pretty much became the standard, though early attempts to cash in on Steven's movie, like the Roger Corman-produced Carnosaur, may do with a guy in a suit, much like the Japanese kaiju movies. Every kid loves dinosaurs, and movies with prehistoric monsters have filled theaters since way back when Gertie walked the cartoon Earth. There is no dearth of dinosaur stories to tell, the latest being 65, set on the planet Earth some 65 million years ago. Writer-directors Scott Beck and Brian Woods have come up with a new twist in Tales of Space and Time, and they are here to tell us all about living in a prehistoric cinematic world. This episode is sponsored by Paramount Home Entertainment. From director Yoko Okumura comes Unseen. In the film, two women form an unlikely connection when a depressed gas station clerk, Sam, played by Jolene Purdy, receives a call from Emily Midori Francis, a nearly blind woman who is running from her murderous ex in the woods. Emily must survive the ordeal with Sam being her eyes from afar using a video call. Unseen is available now via digital and on demand. Guys, welcome back. It's not many who return for an encore performance, and it's so exciting to have you here.
We've been looking forward to this for, I think, the last 4 years since we were last year in 2019. So
yes, thank you for having us back.
Well, it's great to have you back, especially under these circumstances, but not everybody knows your background. Not everybody heard the first show, but you guys have been paired since the University of Iowa.
Yeah, Brian and I even go back further. Like, we were 11 years old when we first met in Bedendorf, Iowa, and we were making stop motion videos. I mean, very much like your incredible introduction, you know, the stop motion was our first experimentation with videos and with dinosaurs.
That's cool. Yeah. I did it in 8mm when I was a kid. Stop motion, yeah. Disappearing yeah. things and moving things around.
Yeah. We were kids when Jurassic Park came out. And so to a certain degree, that was one of our first early introductions to the world of dinosaurs, and we were
and
there.
That's 30 years ago. 30 Can years you ago. Believe it?
June 11, 1993.
Yeah.
My mom actually was taking me to the movie theater, and Arnold Schwarzenegger's Last Action Hero was coming out right around then, and that was the only movie I wanted to see. And she was like, no, we're going to see something called Jurassic Park. I'm like, what does the word Jurassic mean?
Yeah.
I had no understanding of what I was about to step into, and it was quite a world she introduced me to.
Well, it certainly changed the course of your lives eventually.
Yeah.
So tell me about those little movies and videos and stop motion and the playing around that you did.
Yeah, it was always just a fun hobby that we had, and making movies in growing up in the Midwest, and making movies in middle school and high school, we advanced to feature-length films that were absolutely horrible, but we were learning how to do it all. We were learning how to write and direct and shoot the movies and hold the boom mic, and even we would have local casting calls and hold auditions, and we'd be these 15-year-old twerps sitting behind a big desk auditioning seasoned actors in the local community, and in retrospect it was kind of absurd, but to us it seemed normal.
But it was the revenge of the nerds.
Yes, exactly.
In real life,
exactly.
In real time.
Yeah, and so, it's just movies are just something we've always adored and loved and have pursued it passionately ever since. We kind of are self-taught filmmakers. We didn't really go to film school.
Not a lot of film school in Idaho.
It's a state that appreciates writers for sure. But
that's right. Famous writers conferences
like Iowa Writers Workshop. They fostered some of the best authors and screenwriters that we've ever read. And there's a history of literature, but I think for us, it was between reading books as kids, writing plays, making these movies, but then also coming of age when DVDs really were having commentaries and special features and being able to see the dirtiness at which filmmaking really came together versus the glossy, EPKs that just show, talking heads being like, oh, so-and-so is excellent to work with.
You see the
stress on the director's face in the raw, fly on the wall making ofs.
Which I used to make.
So. Yes, absolutely. I mean, they were instrumental.
Being able to do that on Gremlins and Goonies and
exactly.
Escape from New York and all that stuff.
Oh,
that
wow.
was my film school.
Yes.
Was learning from that and then later on Amazing Stories. But you had great success in at university with mm-hmm. your film. You won a competition with MTV and MTVU.
Yeah. At the time, it felt like finally, Eureka, the doors had opened in this development deal that we received with MTV Films. Felt like that's the big step. And I think we won that when we were about 20, 21 years old. And it, to be honest, it was a bit of a expectation that totally undercut itself, in that we thought, oh, we've got this contract with this movie studio, and the contract literally got negotiated for what, 4 years, was it?
4 years.
It was something absurd.
They didn't take it very seriously.
Apparently not.
Exactly. And I think at the end of 4 years, they were kind of like, here's a paltry $5,000, you can spare us the development, you can spare us the pitch that you want to give us, we don't really need your movie, we'll just give you this tiny sum of money. And we were like, all right, that was depressing, but let's take that money and go shoot a pilot. And we're going to put MTV's, if you guys give us permission, we'll put MTV's logo on it and we'll treat it like a professional, like you guys paid us to go make a pilot. And that's how we treated it. And so we were able to go make this 20-minute pilot presentation called Spread. That's never seen the light of day, but it became a calling card for us as directors. Wow. Really, really early in our career. So we kind of
We got to this part in our last conversation. I don't think we did.
So, don't really talk about it much, but it was an exercise in patience and the disappointment that the business can bring, but also in trying to take, I guess, the lemons and turn it into lemonade in some weird way. So we made this pilot and it's, I wouldn't say it got our foot in the door, but it got us access. People would watch it and take us a little bit more seriously because we had the MTV brand behind it.
Right. You had something to show.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. And then you finally got to do a feature that was released by Lionsgate.
Right.
So that was Nightlight. Tell me how that came together. Was that something that you cobbled together on your own, or it was financed by Lionsgate, or how was that done?
It was actually concurrently with the MTV project. While we were directing that, we were writing the screenplay for Nightlight, which was in the heyday of found footage filmmaking, and our concept was, can we do a found footage movie that has a bit more finesse? Like, that was the ambition, at least.
Like, right. Found footage movies are always, we love them. They're amazing, but they're always, like, they're inherently the ugliest movies in cinema history.
Until Paranormal Activity.
Absolutely. And so we thought, we had this weird concept of, what if we shot an entire movie from the point of view of a flashlight that this girl brings into a haunted forest?
That was
the conceit. And in our minds, and this sounds silly in retrospect, but at the time we were like, what if, you know, if Stanley Kubrick directed a found footage movie, what would it look like? It would have a little bit more style and the aesthetic would be a little bit more elevated, and this is crazy talk, but like, that was kind of the ambition in the moment.
We had the ambition that it all takes place as a oneer, which made our life a living hell in production, because we always had to figure out, okay, this is an 8-minute take, and then you had to do that, you know, 10 more times, and you're
and
just
you
like,
have to hide the cut.
Hide the cut.
And there were times, I remember in the edit process, because Brian and I were also the editors on that, we were stringing all the different pieces along. It was probably consisted of like 18 different shots, let's just say, and we got to like the 16th cut and it did not stitch together. And we were like editing at like 3 a.m. We had lost our minds and we just started laughing with hysteria because we had worked for months and months to make this work, and we were like, we just screwed this up. We ended up like, we got it to work, but then we also had this version that's all a oneer, that's like 2 hours long, and we were like, the audience's patience will not withstand the ambitions at which we tried shooting this. And so the final product is not a oneer, but the whole process was having these lofty ambitions and then having to be confronted with the reality of what the story needs, which is filmmaking in a nutshell.
Yeah, so, exactly. Yeah. Well, what must it have been like for you to watch 1917?
Jealousy. But it was beautiful. You know, it was beautiful. We loved it.
And it's
it was,
a great
it's
film.
It's a great and, movie.
You know, obviously there's cuts hidden all over it, but flawlessly so. It's so brilliant.
The blocking is incredible. The storytelling of keeping the camera alive, but not feeling like you're restricting the actor's performance is just amazing. And then having these different set pieces of like the set piece where the flares are going up and the entire world is blanketed in darkness when they disappear. Just the incredible atmosphere that you're able to paint and withstand the audience's ability to watch and want to go on that journey is just top level filmmaking.
Yeah, and emotionally engaging as well. A lot of times when you have a concept so high, you lose track of grounding it in your gut and heart and soul.
It's so true. It's a remarkable piece of screenwriting too. It gets talked a lot about as this impressive directing exercise, but to sustain a story and get you invested in characters in real time is very challenging, and I thought they did a terrific job.
Even if it had been done traditionally, it would still be a great movie.
Exactly.
And the fact that they did it even more powerfully as one unbroken sequence is just amazing.
Absolutely.
So 2016 was a big year for you. This was the year you made the deal to write A Quiet Place.
Yes.
So tell me how that kind of change the nature of what your career trajectory was.
Yeah, it was an interesting point in our career because we had been really frustrated with a lot of different jobs and chasing assignments and our agents leading us down blind alleys, like, you gotta chase this, it's gonna be the next hot thing. And then we'd spend 4 months working on a pitch and just for it to turn into nothing. And so we got frustrated and we wrote A Quiet Place out of that frustration and out of that just desire to really just focus on something that we thought was cool and tried to stop listening to what other people were excited about. And it was a thrilling process. And it was, I don't know, it took us to strange places. Immediately the script got a warm reception from our agents. It went into Paramount. Paramount made a really aggressive offer to make the movie. And the intention was for us to direct.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, the first actor we went to, Mr. John Krasinski, or fortunately, rather, I guess, yeah, I should say, wanted to direct the movie. And not only did he want to direct the movie, he shared the script with his wife the second it came into him. And she wanted to co-star in it. And it was,
wow,
this amazing moment. It was almost incomprehensible. We got whiplash because we were like, I don't understand, like, John and Emily, are they friends? Were they just hanging out when he read the script? We didn't realize that they were married at the time. And we really had to like think like, oh my gosh, are we going to let our baby go? And we just couldn't deny how perfect they were for those roles. And certainly John, as an actor in the business who has worked with many great directors, including Sam Mendes, who we were just talking about with 1917,
yeah,
we just had a gut feeling that he probably learned a thing or two after all those years.
But who would have guessed he would be such a terrific genre director?
Yeah,
total surprise.
That's the thing that surprised me. I mean, he'd directed comedy before,
yes,
and had acted comedy and drama and all, but he understood our genre, you know, gooble, yeah, gobble one of us, is, yeah, we, our often repeated phrase here. And it became such a smash. But it was before it went into production that you guys started making Haunt, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, we were writing A Quiet Place and Haunt concurrently. And they both were scratching different itches that we had of, you know, doing, a family horror genre, but then just doing like a straight up like fun Halloween slasher. And so Haunt was going into production and basically was shooting alongside A Quiet Place back in, this would have been like fall of 2017. And it was fun. Like Haunt was kind of that throwback slasher film that we actually got to film over the course of Halloween in October 2017.
Wow.
And so the spirit at which I think all our collaborators went into that movie with felt like, in retrospect, it created one of the best filmmaking atmospheres that we've ever had, because it really felt like a camaraderie in the wake of, Halloween seasons.
Yeah, I actually was shooting on Halloween a Halloween episode of Once Upon a Time.
Oh, that were you?
Same, no way. Halloween 2017.
Did anyone dress up for Halloween?
Yeah, and we had a set in a bar,
yeah. Yeah.
And we had the Sanderson sisters in costume,
nice,
in that bar there. It took place on Halloween, and we were shooting on Halloween.
Yeah. That's amazing. Did you dress up as anything on Halloween?
No. I was in the background.
Yeah.
But tell me, so Haunt was very grounded, mm-hmm, practical effects,
mm-hmm,
homemade movie making,
yeah,
in the independent sense, very much in the 80s style.
Yes.
And so tell me about that experience, because the evolution of the tools of filmmaking are in a maelstrom at that time,
mm-hmm,
and you're in this, what could be seen as an old-fashioned or, let's say, classic, mm-hmm, filmmaking style, where everything you see is on the set in front of you,
yeah,
and is handmade, and the actors interact with these things.
Absolutely. There's nothing better than having practical, not just, you know, from a cinephile and fan audience standpoint, but from a filmmaking standpoint, so the actors actually have something tangible that they can react to. We certainly know, especially with 65 and some of the effects there, and some are practical, some are CG, that if you don't have something right in front of you, it takes a lot of imagination as a director, but certainly as an actor to, yeah, feel the tangible and palpable fear. With Haunt, You know, we just wanted to make sure everything in this haunted house was operating as if it were a real haunted house. And anytime there was, you know, a moment of violence or whatnot, there always had to be something practical that we all could react to, so that the reality and the authenticity was the first and foremost tone that we were really hitting there.
So how did Eli Roth get involved in his presentation of the film?
Yeah, he read the script. Somebody slipped him the script, and we got a phone call from our producers, Broken Road, and said, Eli read the script. He loved it. And our minds instantly went to, oh, he's going to want to direct this just like John wanted to direct the Quiet. Like, our mind went to, uh-oh, like, I don't know if we're going to be directing any movies this year. And instead he was like, I would really love to kind of mentor this project. I really responded to it. He had been trying to crack a haunted house slasher film for a long time, and he felt like the haunt was the answer to those questions that he had about, could you do a movie where people innocently go into a haunted house and the horror that happens inside of there turns out to be real. And Eli was just really, really supportive, a great mentor. Working with other filmmakers is so... therapeutic, I guess, is the word I would use, because they've been through it all. They've seen everything. You know, working with Sam Raimi on 65, it was the same way. It's, there's a mentorship element, but there's also just, as a filmmaker's, I don't know how you feel, Mick, but we're always, there's just a lot of anxiety that comes with the job. There's a lot of money on the line. There's a lot of responsibility, and then there's your own artistic hopes and dreams that you're trying to do your best job and constantly failing, and to have a mentor like an Eli Roth or a Sam Raimi watching over you and telling you it's going to be okay, and here's what I did in this situation when it happened to me or whatever the case is, it's just really it's really nice.
Well, it's the situation I had producing Masters of Horror, mm-hmm. working with John Carpenter and Tobe Hooper and Dario Argento. I learned so much from all of them, and my contribution was to be able to step aside and protect them from other people interfering with people whose vision is a lot better than anybody else's that would have had notes.
That's right. So fascinating. We're in a, the business is, it always makes us scratch our head because there's so many terrific filmmakers that we admire throughout the years, but they're stuck in a business that has a hierarchy of, whether it's the financier or the studio that is always trying to kind of nudge the filmmaker one way or the other. And that usually is business related. It's usually about money. And so anytime in your situation with Masters of Horror, where like you can empower those directors to do their best work unencumbered by either creative notes that don't make sense or just aren't coming from the right place, it's beautiful as fans to be able to watch that.
Well, it worked so well to see these guys work at the top of their powers after having their metaphorical balls cut off.
Yes, totally. You know? Yeah.
But let's go back to the idea of platforming your career. You know, A Quiet Place sold for a lot of money to make a big movie, and it was your hopeful entry into being complete filmmakers, because all your collaborative years you've been writing and directing together.
Right.
But here's, Quiet Place was such a big success that had to have opened the door for you to be able to be studio writers and directors.
Right. Yeah. It was surprising, I think, opening weekend with A Quiet Place. So this would have been like April 2018. We had zero expectations of how the movie was going to be received, you know, critically from the audience, financially. And we had a bit of whiplash, to be honest, just because I think our nature and in life is to always expect the worst.
Yeah.
And
it's,
you know,
not
it's
a bad.
No, it's a not. Healthy yeah. point of view, especially for the film business, because usually the worst is what happens.
Yeah.
You do your best and expect the worst. Yeah,
absolutely. Exactly. And so we went into that opening weekend having the worst expectations, and our hair was kind of blown back by the fact that the audiences embraced it as much as they did.
And the critics as
the
well.
The critics as well, yeah. Which is sometimes a really rare alchemy to hit. But Paramount was instantly announcing the sequel to A Quiet Place before anybody involved outside of the studio, including John and Emily, I'm sure, had a chance to understand what this meant. And Brian and I, meanwhile, we had been working on a few different ideas in the background. And this dinosaur movie idea, 65, was something that was at the top of our list, but we never knew when the right opportunity would present itself, if ever, to get the resources to make it. And if the success of A Quiet Place taught us anything, it's that amidst a landscape where there's a lot of remakes and IP-based material and sequels, which we love, but we also want to see the opportunity for films not based on anything to also have their chance at the cinema. And so it felt like the right time to try and make 65. The caveat was, we were like, do we go pitch this directly to a studio and try to get like paid to write this? Or do we incubate the script by ourselves, just write it on spec, which is ultimately the decision we made, because we wanted to figure out the story and have our own little system that we used on A Quiet Place to write it inside a bubble and really determine
without
the best
being
version.
Poisoned by executive input.
And it's just so much more fun. I'm curious if you have a reaction to that, Mick, in your own career, but like we love the fun of writing.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's not as fun if you're working with a studio that has expectations. Like, we heard a pitch, they think they know what it is, and then they read the script and sometimes they're just like, well, this isn't what we were picturing. And then you go through this kind of notes process. The fun of writing something on spec is it's just whatever you want to do.
Yeah. Almost everything I do on spec.
Oh, wonderful.
Or it'll be in collaboration, like Clive Barker or Stephen King or somebody like that. Mm-hmm. You know, and at this point in my career, if it doesn't sell, it doesn't sell.
Yes.
I've written another script that I can be proud of, whether it becomes a financial success or not. But then it's on to the next one. And maybe that will sell and maybe it won't. But it's not wasted time,
not
because
wasted
you're
time.
Always getting better.
You're always learning. That rings so true. You're always learning and. Yeah.
I'm curious if this has happened to you also, because we've written scripts, like we were doing our, again, all on spec, like writing a revisionist tale of the Pied Piper, and that story went nowhere, but there were character elements that we ended up using in A Quiet Place. And even in 65, like there's set pieces and such that we were using in other discarded screenplays. Have you ever piggybacked off of that?
There have been pieces that I've taken out from, you know, the original version of The Fly 2 was going to be something very different, and it was going to involve the anti-abortion movement and all of this. And I ended up taking elements from that into another spec thing that I'm still working on and may not have
incredible.
A future, but and Fly 2 was way back in, you know, 19
89.
So written before that,
but
ideas are good ideas, and if you're working on something and you've had that thought before and it fits into that peg, you know, the peg fits into the groove, it's exciting, and making it work that way. So As a team, how do you work? Do you sit together in like this podcast studio is my writing studio as well. This is my office. This is where I do all of my writing.
Yeah.
But I write by myself almost all the time.
Yeah.
So what is the process of a writing directing duo when you're in the creation stage?
So we like to brainstorm together. We like to get in a room together, throw ideas out, challenge each other, pitch, get excited about things. Sometimes we'll be working on a different project and we're just in the room together and we'll be like, oh yeah, and by the way, on 65, like we should probably do, like, if we're going to do a raptor, we should probably do a small raptor. You know, we might just pitch stuff in the room. But when we write, it is a very private process. We are never in the same room together. We separate and we go into our respective offices and bang out pages. And I think part
of... So do you
of,
say, like, I'm going to do this scene,
exactly,
you do that scene?
Exactly. So we'll kind of... Usually, as far as, like, outlining, we'll kind of have a decent idea of the first act. We'll kind of have talked through it enough times that we know the beats of the first act, and then we'll have a very fuzzy idea of the second act, and we'll only have a vague idea of the ending. We think it kind of ends like this, but we're not really sure. That's about as much preparation as we like to do, so that then Scott or myself can go, all right, I'll take the first 10 pages. And we go off and we lock ourselves in a room when we write, and I think it's in part one because I think if we were in the room together, we'd be kind of a bit joking and laughing too much and having too much fun, totally distract each other. But also too, I think when our writing is firing at its best, it's very personal, and you're almost revealing something private about yourself, and it helps to just be in a very kind of safe and closed space. And then once we have those pages, we sheepishly hand it to the other person and go, please don't murder me. This is what I'm thinking. and we get feedback, and then we challenge each other and try
to make
it stronger.
You trust anybody more than you trust since you've known each other since you were 11 years old?
Absolutely. I mean, I would say there's times where I really believe in something that I've written, which is rare because there's always like that imposter syndrome. But I'll believe in it, and then I'll send it to Brian, and then he has a conviction that no, we should do it this opposite way. And I'm like, I will trust you on this because I kind of require that feedback, and I don't even know how I could write by myself, to be honest.
There's not a battle going on. Usually, if you're at opposite ends of a decision, one of you will lie on your back.
Usually, if we're on a different page, we'll convince each other to switch sides, and then we'll be on the other side of the spectrum. And we're like, oh no, now what? but it really helps, like. We're great readers. Like, we love reading screenplays. We used to go to the bookstores and buy scripts off the shelves. Wow. We still do, actually. I still go to
Samuel
used bookstores.
French, yeah.
I love going to the last bookstore downtown and seeing, like, what screenplays do they have today that I can pick up. And we're lovers of the form, of the screenplay form, but I can genuinely say, like, Scott's one of my favorite writers. So when we're handing pages back and forth, it's thrilling. I'm excited to see what he's come up with, and I'm excited to try to challenge him and push it a little further.
It kind of allows us to be each other's audience too, and therefore, like, even though we know the outline and the story beats, there's everything that you have to fill in the gaps between dialogue and a bit of specific action and such that we get to really react to. And like Brian's saying, it's usually a really enjoyable process and inspires. You know, if he's delivering pages, all of a sudden I'm inspired by a brand new idea that none of us had talked about yet.
Well, what all of us agree on is we really enjoy the process of writing, and a lot of writers don't.
Yes.
Most of them like having written, but the process itself is like surgery.
Have you always liked writing? Because for us, it was harder and more painful earlier, and the older we get, the more we're starting to enjoy it. And I don't know if that's a normal thing, or have you always enjoyed the process?
Well,
I
started seriously writing at 12.
Right.
Yeah.
And it was the most fun thing in the world for me, and I've always felt that way, but I didn't have commercial success. I didn't make a living as a screenwriter until I was 33, so it was a relatively late start.
Yeah.
But it was out of the joy of it that it happened. And the first guy to hire me, as we've talked about before, is Steven Spielberg. And so he is so encouraging to writers and creators that I could not have had a more encouraging mentor who taught me so much more than he knows he taught me.
Amazing.
You know, I appreciate so much the limbs that he didn't realize he was going out on and allowing me to do. You know, one of the things he told me, and this was more as a director than as a writer, was do something you'd be afraid of being fired for. Do something inventive that you'd be afraid of being fired for doing.
Awesome.
Because I promise you, I'm not going to fire you.
Oh, what a great note.
And that freedom, that noose was thrown aside.
Wow.
You know? And just that kind of encouragement. And the process of writing has always been a fun one for me, and one that I enjoy doing, to the point where, you know, you talk about doing your 10 pages. When I'm clicking, 10 pages is a normal day.
Yep.
And I love that process.
Yeah.
And I've co-written, and I've done it happily with a few people, but I find myself freest, not trying to talk somebody into my point of view.
Yeah, no, I believe it. Like, everybody has their own system, and we love that idea of, like, that I'm gonna ingrain that in my head, the idea of, like, doing something that you would risk getting fired for. I feel like that's the most exciting place to be as a filmmaker. And I remember one of our first critical reviews of one of the films that we screened for a college class when we were like 16 or 17 years old. This critique was like, Beck and Woods are aspiring to mediocrity. And that was that was such a terrifying sentence that I read, where I'm like, I never want us to aspire to mediocrity, because my favorite filmmakers, their films, if you know, do them injustice, but still look at the Rotten Tomatoes score, like, usually my favorite films are somewhere between 40 to 60%. And I'm like, that's kind of the sweet spot where you love it or you hate it. And it's usually because it's defying an expectation and it's doing something bold because of it.
Right. So. And the most memorable films are the ones that aren't part of a franchise.
Yes.
You know, you guys notably were not a part of A Quiet Place too.
Right. Yeah.
And you were going your own route, writing your own spec stuff. Let's talk about dinosaurs. We can make the transition to today, to today now, but I'm assuming it will take you back to your childhood. Mm-hmm. What were your first favorite dinosaur movies?
Oh, I remember, I want to say it's like a 1960 movie or 1960s movie just called Dinosaur. And
not Dinosaurus?
Dinosaur. It's where a dinosaur is taken out of deep freeze and basically unleashed. And my uncle showed this to me when I was really, really little. And I think it was the combination of seeing a dinosaur interacting with modern day humans that struck my imagination. And later, when I was about 12 or 13, when Spielberg's The Lost World came out, and seeing that third act where a dinosaur, the T-Rex, is running amok around San Diego, that just ignited like a fire inside me, where it was like, oh, I get to see a dinosaur destroy like a cityscape. That was just incredible. And I think, you know, there are also all of the different references that you had mentioned before of like watching King Kong, like the 1933 King Kong.
Yeah.
That struck me at such a young age of what you could do in a movie, even though I was watching it at a time far removed from the techniques of stop motion, and we were already moving into like CGI at that point. It still felt like it was magic.
It was still fun. I mean, I remember too, like King Kong and the original The Lost World, and seeing the dinosaur effects.
The original 1925 or the 1960s?
The 1925.
Yeah.
And
Willis O'Brien.
Yes. And as a kid, and even as like a teenager, those movies, I didn't watch them and go, oh, these dinosaurs look ridiculous. Like, it's not CGI.
So
you
cheesy.
Actually, you watch it and you're like, wow, dinosaurs. I love dinosaurs are so amazing. And wow, what, like, how did they bring these to life? Even though, you know, the techniques and the effects were antiquated, there was still, as you said, Scott, there's still a magic about it. Mm-hmm. These larger than life creatures that somehow incomprehensibly used to walk on the same earth that we're all on, and watching them executed in a film and be scary and majestic, and there's nothing better. And and honestly, that's when we started thinking about 65. Our whole pitch to the studios was basically, why are you guys letting Steven Spielberg have all the fun? We're just going to stop making dinosaur movies now that Jurassic Park dropped the gauntlet. Like, come on. Like, there's a whole history of dinosaur. It used to be a subgenre.
And you got an outer space dinosaur movie.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. It felt like my uncle Dwayne, for Christmas, when I was a little kid, like 5 or 6, he would unleash all these VHS tapes that were ostensibly B movies, and there was a lot of like Godzilla movies and like Rodan, and just watching all these creature features, it felt unfair to a certain degree that entire genre had gone missing as far as we were concerned. And 65 was that sticky idea that I feel like has stuck around since we were kids watching these movies for the first time, or seeing Jurassic Park when we were, I think, like 8 years old. And it just felt like the right opportunity to try and take the wild dive into this script and see what we could cook up.
Well, what was the pitch?
The pitch was, like, once we were at the, like, refining the pitch, we had already written the script, but we were like, what if we transport the audiences back 65 million years ago? It's not about taking dinosaur DNA and putting it modern day. It's like you actually get to transport audiences back to Pangean Earth. And
when we developed it, Sam Raimi had read the script, came on board, wanted to produce the movie, and as a great mentor would, he's like, fellas, I love this movie. I think this is a great script. But we have to convince the studios to make this movie because it's a very big budget and you've only done an independent film. So what I'd like to do is commission some artwork. And so Sam paid for some artwork for us to put together our vision of the movie, basically.
Great.
And so we would go into all the different boardrooms when we had the script, and we would pitch a movie, and we started pitching it almost like we were pitching like Ridley Scott's Alien. We were like pitching a story about a pilot who's traversing across the Gulf of Space,
which is what it looks like, which is what it looks like.
Exactly.
There was a degree at which we kind of were leaning into, this is boring, you've seen this movie before, because once Mills crash lands on a mysterious planet and he thinks there's something alien out there, that's when we would land the reveal in the like boardrooms, where we flipped around a poster, we're like, he didn't land on a mysterious planet. He landed on Earth 65 right. million years ago. And we have this poster that said 65 million years ago, someone came to Earth with a giant T-Rex with a smoke trail of a ship crash landing on Earth.
And fortunately, the technology of Chimera is very similar to modern day Earth technology.
Exactly. So we had fun with that reveal, and that reveal does exist in the movie in the hopes that like 20 years from now, if there's some kid that's chooses to watch a movie called 65 and never saw any of the marketing material, he might start watching Adam Driver crash land on a mysterious planet. And then that reveal comes up, and hopefully that becomes a moment for him.
And now that's not going to be much of a surprise because of the marketing.
Yeah.
Not right now.
You have to let people know what they're in for them to pay for a ticket.
Yeah. We're in a, you know, weird time with theaters, right? There's nothing more important to us than the theatrical experience. Scott and I are actually opening a movie theater this fall in our hometown.
Really?
Yeah, so, yeah, it's called The Last Picture House. It's going to screen 35 millimeter film prints. We're going to beg you to come back and screen some
I'll
of your
be
work.
There. Yeah.
And
just like Quentin did with the New Beverly.
Yeah, totally. Yes. That's exactly right. And our community where we grew up, they love movies there, and we think that there's an audience for it. But yeah, it's a trying time for non-IP original films in the theatrical marketplace. And while it would have been fun to kind of hide the secret of 65 completely, we also kind of understood why Sony wanted to put it out there and draw people in with the dinosaurs.
And it certainly doesn't ruin anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if anything, it piques people's interest.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So tell me about the difference in approach. This was probably not even remotely like making Haunt.
Mm-hmm.
Not even the same job being directors. So you're working on stages. The spaceship sets, I assume, were actual sets.
Yes. Yeah.
But most everything else, you're in front of a green screen, actors in front of a green screen with C-stands with green tennis balls on the end for their points of view and the like.
Yeah.
So tell me about what a big 360-degree turn that is from making a movie like Haunt.
I mean, it was massive. There was this period, even before we started prep, where it was like an R&D phase, where we always storyboard every single frame of our movie, but never was it more important to figure out, how are we going to show the dinosaurs? When do we not show the dinosaurs? What's the visual effects cost implication of showing too many dinosaurs? And it was all this homework that had to be done to figure out what the actual cost of the movie was. Then it was about designing the dinosaurs with our visual effects supervisors and any practical effects that we could afford to have. And then it was about, versus like Haunt, which we shot entirely in this contained haunted house that we built in a milk factory in outside of Cincinnati, Ohio. We actually decided, let's film as much on location as we can in Louisiana and in Oregon. And that process was built out of research with paleontologists and researchers that were figuring out what the ecology was in the United States back then, 65 million years ago. We had written this kind of as the anti-Jurassic Park, because we didn't want to necessarily do like a tropical jungle. We wanted to do the Pacific Northwest and what it actually seemed like in the late Cretaceous period. And the research came back, and it was basically telling us the temperate climate was very different back then. It was more like the swamps of Louisiana, which drove us to shooting actually in swamps. And so one of the most magical days on set was, it was like 10 days into photography, And I remember walking out on the spaceship that our construction team and production designer actually built in this swampland and had mounted it so that it wouldn't sink, but that it looked like it was completely decimated. And we had fires being lit up and we had techno cranes. And just to see the collaborative artistry all come together in that one set was absolutely breathtaking. And we had to pinch ourselves because never in a million years did we think like we would be able to shoot this movie in the wake of Haunt. And and it was a world away in terms of the amount of homework it took to get there.
You know, and it was a really tough movie. All shoots are difficult and challenging. This was a particularly tough challenge. It was a 40-day shoot with a lot of visual effects.
Mm-hmm. No second unit.
No second unit, 6-day weeks. I mean, we were exhausted. We started with like, why does Steven Spielberg get to have all the fun? And ended with like, it's not that fun. Yeah. It's hard to do.
Hey, even Critters 2 was a 40-day shoot.
Oh, wow. Yeah, and it was just, you know, it was challenging, but it was rewarding work. We were working with a kind of big canvas, maximalist, giant dinosaurs, but we also were attempting to do, and I don't know if we pull it off, but we were attempting to do kind of an intimate character story that really doesn't rely on dialogue, and it's very kind of nonverbal. And we talked about 65 as kind of like another attempt, like A Quiet Place, to do a modern day silent film, because we're just really love that period of film, and we love the romantic idea of how silent films could kind of play anywhere globally in different countries, and there was no barrier to language, that cinema was a universal language that kind of unites everybody.
Well, the tools of cinema go beyond language, and it's what separates it from theater.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what we find so beautiful, because you can access so many different ways to convey emotion, whether that's through like a color that you're using in the production design or some sort of sound effect that sparks your imagination. For us, it's always like about what you don't see, you know, that is really the most terrifying when you're working in the genre.
So how do you work as co-directors? Does somebody specialize in working with the actors and somebody else with visuals, or do you divide that up?
Yeah, it's really interchangeable in that we're always doing our homework. You know, while we're in pre-production, we're storyboarding everything, figuring out like what's the purpose of a certain scene, so that when we get to rehearsals or get to set, that there are really no questions that are going to be left unanswered, at least between the two of us.
Because you guys are going to be getting 100 questions a day.
Absolutely. And there's a lot of trust too. Like on rare occasions will, you know, a question arise and like, I may be slightly uncertain, but Brian feels a little more certain and he'll give that answer and I'll trust that. But I would say for the most part, like we're sitting at, you know, Video Village and we'll watch a scene, we'll quickly whisper a few different, you know, ideas for, okay, for take two, let's try this. And it could be either one of us or maybe both of us that goes up and talks to the actor. And then the next take, it might be the other person, but it's always having this quick conference and make sure that we're always communicating like a singular vision, which is really important to us.
Well, you're also doing your first movie star movie. You got Adam Driver here, and you know that had to be also a very different experience than doing an indie.
Yeah, Adam Driver's one of our favorite actors of all time. Yeah. He's been doing tremendous work, movie after movie. It's very intimidating to work with him because we're such fans of his body of work. There was a day on set where Scott and I made the decision. We were like, all right, we're going to get a bunch of Cirque du Soleil performers, dress them up in these giant dinosaur suits, and put them in the deep background so the actors have something to react to. And so we made it a big deal with our like line producer. We're like, we have to have the circus, you know, slush fund for the raptor suits. It was like this huge thing. So they finally show up and we're standing outside of a soundstage and we're getting ready to film. And there's like six people in raptor suits. Some of them are eating like, you know, drinking coffee in the raptor. It was just like comical. And Scott and I looked at each other like, oh no, this is going to be the day Adam is like, what am I doing working with you guys? And so Adam comes out, we place the raptors in the background and he comes up to us and we're like, here it comes. He's going to think this is absurd. And he looks at the raptors, points at them, and he's like, I love this. Like, I love that there's something real on set to react to. Like, and that was like a big moment for us as first time studio directors working with a movie star, because you're always afraid that they've worked with so many tremendous directors that you're not going to be delivering the goods for them.
So what was the most challenging scene in the movie, filled with challenging scenes?
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, it did feel like every day we're on a new location. There's new terrain. I think there's a scene. It's sometimes like the emotional scenes, because if there was dialogue there, we kept questioning ourselves. And I think like Adam, we were all having this like conference of, is less more? Like, do we need to strip more dialogue out of there? If we strip the dialogue out of there, like, how heightened do we play the performance to make sure we communicate it? Because I think between the two of us and also with Adam, subtlety was always key. We didn't want to push sentiment too hard or really push the themes too hard. And so it was about always getting more options than we probably needed, but making sure we were policing ourselves so that we didn't commit something awful to film that then could backfire and then it gets put in the final version of it. I'm trying to think of like one scene in particular. Do you have?
No, it was a challenging food. I don't know what else to say. It was a big budget movie that we had to cut a lot of money out of, and we were constantly making script revisions and just being in the studio process a little bit more for the first time was
you found them having a lot of input.
Absolutely. Yeah. And sometimes in a great way and sometimes in a challenging way, you know, to think quick and try to react to the pivoting opinions of a large corporation that's making a larger movie. It was a learning process. It was exciting and thrilling and exhausting.
And you're spending their money.
Very true.
Yeah. I mean, there's a degree at which you have to acknowledge you're spending their money, so you can't just go off and, like when we were kids, and do whatever we want. There's that balance of the politics and the diplomacy too.
So, right, which is a huge part of being a director.
It is, yeah.
And not just dealing with the studio, but with cast and crew as well.
Yeah.
So tell me how you went about crewing, and particularly the VFX people, DP, the sound design.
We worked with some really, really remarkable people on this film. The first person that comes to mind is the costume designer, Michael Kaplan, who started his career with Blade Runner. And
beginning.
Exactly. And just went on from there, did a lot of David Fincher movies, did the recent Star Wars films and Star Trek, and using his creativity to kind of create what we kept calling, it's like a ancient alien civilization. It's like retro and futuristic simultaneously, which was a hard bullseye to hit. And our production designer, Kevin Ishioka, who we admired his design work from Tron and Oblivion. He's done some really beautiful sci-fi kind of cutting edge stuff, and having his taste and style imprinted on the movie was really, really exciting for us.
And our visual effects supervisor, Chris Harvey, he was somebody that we admired from his work with Neil Blomkamp, who had a great way of like combining reality with visual effects. And Chris had spearheaded Neil Blomkamp's Oats Studios that was churning out some really incredible short films.
Yeah, we had Neil on talking about Oats and everything.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. So like we just love that sensibility. And what Chris lent to everything that he works on is the idea of storytelling and not just visual effects. And how do you tell the best story possible? Like, if Chris could just go off and make his own movie as a director, I think he'd be incredibly successful, even if it was void of visual effects. And the other key collaborator was Sal Tatino, our cinematographer, who has shot tons of films with Ron Howard, from Cinderella Man to Frost Nixon, like intimate character dramas. But then he's also done physical jobs like Everest, where they actually shot part of that on Everest.
Right.
And yet this seemed like a bit of a departure for Sal, because we wanted to approach with a bit of a controlled, thoughtful style, where we're storyboarding, again, like every single frame. And we always were wondering, like, before we brought Sal on board, we're like, is he going to want to do that? Or does he kind of beat to his own drum?
And there was so much technology involved.
Absolutely. And the good news is he was like a kid in a candy store, where he was so excited to chase this style of filmmaking. He started inventing new equipment devices that we could use. There's one shot where we wanted like a full 360 that's low to the ground, and we didn't want to use a steady cam because we wanted it to be really controlled. We wanted it to be at like a singular pace. and it couldn't be like a crane because that would be in its own way, and it was a tight set. And so he worked with his camera equipment team, and they devised this entire new system that we used for a track. And so it was just really incredible to see him get inspired, and then in turn, like, that inspired us to concoct even crazier ideas throughout the course of pre-production.
What do you think the appeal of dinosaurs is? Every kid loves dinosaurs, especially little boys, but not just little boys.
I think it's the idea that dinosaurs seem like they were created simply for movies, but the reality is they existed here on Earth.
They were real.
It's an incredible thought to think somewhere here in the San Fernando Valley, there might have been T-Rexes roaming, you know, along Ventura Boulevard. And it's so wild as a child to see like a Godzilla movie, but then you see a T-Rex movie. And Godzilla is invented, but a T-Rex is not invented.
It's the real thing.
It's absolutely extraordinary.
So, Brian, what were the movies that you watched for inspiration during the prep?
We watched, we screened Alien for the cast, for Driver and the young actress, Ariana Greenblatt, who plays Koa in the movie. We screened Alien just to set a tone for what great performances that are terrified of a creature. Studied a lot of creature features. Some of the movies that you might not expect for this film, we watched Gravity. We really love these kind of point A to point B movies that are simple, or appear simple, deceptively simple character stories that are about action and these kind of setting up these dominoes and watching them all fall throughout the movie as things get worse and worse for our heroes. So
both versions of True Grit also.
Yeah, both versions of True Grit, Apocalypto.
The guy and the young girl.
Exactly.
That's right. I mean, Paper Moon, if we want to get.
That's a great one too. We were trying to balance. I mean, the whole movie is an exercise in delivering the B-movie premise, but also embracing like the character journey and the idea of the undercurrent of like suffering loss and suffering grief. So it was always like a Venn diagram of those, like a character movie, but something that's steeped in genre.
Well, you talked about, because of budgetary issues, having to trim things. Were there any scenes that had to hit the floor before they were shot that were really painful?
All of them, anything, but I mean, that's the nature of Scott and I. Everything's painful.
Right.
It's a tough business for very sensitive people. Unfortunately,
yeah, that's for sure.
Sometimes I wonder if we're in the right career. But absolutely, there are things on the cutting room floor, both as screenwriters and as filmmakers. But that is filmmaking, right? It's adapting to what the resources you have. You adapt to the weather that you get on the day, and we admire filmmakers who are able to kind of navigate that as if it's easy. For us, it's always a challenge. But you watch Martin Scorsese, and it seems like he is undaunted by anything, even studio interference. You hear him talk about on some of his movies, and it's like, oh, that masterpiece was interfered with? Because
they're telling Martin Scorsese what to do.
Of course. Well, that's always unacceptable. But yeah.
So tell me about your anticipation for opening day. this is your first big studio movie, wide release. A lot of advertising, and as we're recording this, the film has not yet come out.
Right.
So what are your plans for opening day?
Turn the phone off and focus on the future. Like I always think about like Spielberg and Lucas like escaping.
Going to Hawaii.
Yeah, exactly. And that sounds really, really nice. What we've done, we did this with Haunt and with A Quiet Place, is we go back to Iowa. And we go back to Iowa in part because that's where we feel most grounded. I live there much of the time. Mm. And we just have such a great community. So we're doing like three screenings back in Iowa. And I think that I'm looking forward to most because we get to see so many familiar faces, people that we started making movies with when we were kids. But I don't know, like, again, we're the type of filmmakers where it's out of our control. And so we can expect for the worst, but again, like it is out of our control. And so at this point, you just have to let the audience live with the movie, whether they love it, whether they hate it, and just be focused on what we can do next. And so we're always terrified, I think. So.
Do you show up and watch your movies in theaters? Is that a big moment for you? Is that a big opportunity?
Absolutely, especially genre movies where you can really read an audience.
Yeah.
You know, they're verbal. Comedies and horror movies go for a visceral and observable response.
Yeah, absolutely.
And to, like, opening night at the Chinese Theater with Sleepwalkers, 1,200 people in there, and when Mother and Son kiss, hearing them all go, ew! At the same time is one of the most memorable nights of my life.
Yeah, that's incredible.
But I'm so excited for you and wish you all the best. It was so great to have you back, and we'll do it next time.
Oh, thank you so much, Mick.
So thanks, Scott. Thanks, Brian. Yeah, it's really good to see you, and I wish you all the best.
Oh, thank you, Mick.
Thank you for listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris. Download new episodes every Wednesday or subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Postmortem with Mick Garris is produced by Mick Garris and Joe Russo. Our sound engineer is Christopher Leon Price. Our announcer is Jeff Gelb. Our graphic designer is John Holland. And our theme was composed and performed by Bill Burney with additional music by John Jasensky. If you're enjoying our show, please take a moment to rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you for listening to the Dread Podcast Network.